Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on proposed school closures in Hammond. Lake County officers will be featured on a new show about first responders. Brandon Smith reports on the latest conflict between the Indiana Attorney General and Marion County Prosecutor over a state abortion lawsuit. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Kira Amstutz from Indiana Humanities. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Public service wasn't just a promise. She did it for a living. Lake County Sheriff Roy Dominguez shared these sentiments to a packed crowd at Lake County Councilwoman Elsie Franklin's funeral held Thursday at the Genesis Convention Center. Dominguez said he first met Franklin a quarter of a century ago when she worked for Gary Police as a radio dispatcher. He said she took that passion into local politics and county government, where she oversaw the spending of public dollars for essential government services across the county. The Times reports Franklin was laid to rest Thursday at Evergreen Memorial Park in Hobart following the large memorial service. Lake County Commissioner Kyle Allen, County Councilman Charlie Brown, and Lake County Chairman Jim Weezer were among those present. Darren Washington, a minister and Calumet Township trustee, helped preside over the proceedings. Franklin, 81, died May 6th, leaving behind a large family and a bevy of friends and supporters who turned out Thursday. More than 400 attended the memorial service. Franklin was first elected to represent much of the city of Gary from her 2nd District County Council seat in 2002. Although poor health forced her to miss council meetings in 2014 and 2015, she returned to work afterward, overcoming her medical issues. Franklin ran and won her 5th term in office last year. Lake County Assessor Jerome Prince, who won the Gary mayoral primary earlier this month, spoke to the crowd as well.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Facing a $10.2 million deficit in 2020, Hammond plans to close Columbia and Lafayette Elementary, as well as Miller Preschool, and cut 130 to 150 jobs. The plan was announced during a school board work session Wednesday night at the school administration building. A formal vote is scheduled for next Tuesday at 6 p.m. New Superintendent Scott Miller characterized the move as painful but the right decision. The Post Tribune reports closure plans for Columbia and Lafayette were floated back in 2017 as part of Hammond's successful referendum proposals. Miller says, currently, Hammond is facing a combination of financial pressures that leave it no choice but to boost student enrollment and cut expenses. That includes a $5 million deficit combined with $900,000 lost to property tax caps in 2020, as well as $1.7 million less in state funding due to declining enrollment. Superintendent Miller's plan has three parts: enrolling more students, closing three schools, and cutting staff. He has proposed to reopen enrollments, which has attracted students from East Chicago and Gary in the past. Hammond closed enrollment with its 2017 referendum. In fall 2018, the district lost 545 students, which meant a $3.6 million loss. If Hammond could attract 100 to 200 more students, that would mean $684,000 to $1.3 million more. In unofficial spring counts, it lost another 122 students. The district will also propose opening a virtual school, as well as providing an alternative for some students to graduate with online coursework. Of the proposed school closures, Superintendent Miller said all three are aging buildings in need of significant repairs. In total, those closures would save $1.28 million in operating costs. It would allow Hammond to avoid $2.8 million in building repairs. After the move, each school would move closer to capacity. Trustee Carlotta Blake King asked if more cuts were coming. Consultants had suggested closing two of Hammond's four high schools, likely Clark and Gavitt, which were not part of the current plan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
When a sub-zero cold snap hit Northwest Indiana in late January, several schools closed for most of the week. A state spokesman said, now select schools will have the option to write off missed weather days. The rules were issued in a memo on February 22nd. Qualified schools or districts that earn an A grade have been allowed to bank up school time, effectively letting them cancel out those days if they have enough hours saved. Indiana Department of Education spokesman Adam Baker said, qualified schools or districts that earned an A grade have been allowed to bank up school time, effectively letting them cancel out those days if they have enough hours saved. Munster announced in March via Facebook its school year would end on time on May 24th. At that time, it had 4 days to make up, with one already done on President's Day. Three others would be excused with approval by the Indiana Department of Education. Eligible high schools had to earn an A under the state's accountability grading system the prior year. It would lose eligibility when it earns a C for 1 year or B for 2 straight years.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Lake County officers will soon get some screen time in an upcoming television show about first responders. Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. and the Lake County Board of Commissioners signed off on an agreement with 44 Blue Productions to film live video with county officers for a show called First Responders Live. Martinez said he got a call from the production company after it researched departments across the country. The show will have cameras set up inside the Sheriff's Department facility. The footage will have a delay so it can be reviewed to make sure no private or sensitive information is aired. Martinez said the show will focus on police officers, firefighters, and EMTs. He goes on to say, quote, I think it's going to be great exposure. Last year, a Fox production used the Geary Courthouse and Hammond City Hall to film a pilot episode of a new legal drama.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Chamber of Commerce is warning the trade war with China could threaten Hoosier businesses. The group says the state exports more than $1 billion of goods to China, and the damage to Indiana businesses from higher tariffs could be, quote, devastating. Chamber President Kevin Brenninger says there are important trade issues that need to be addressed with China, but he cautions against putting U.S. businesses in the crossfire.
The businesses are sort of a pawn in this game. I analogize it to sort of gambling with other people's money.
China has retaliated against higher U.S. tariffs with a list of $60 billion worth of U.S. goods they plan to raise tariffs on starting next month.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The state of Indiana proposed a new program Wednesday to help transition people from Indiana's Medicaid expansion program, HIP 2.0, to commercial health insurance. If approved, the HIP Workforce Bridge program will be the first of its kind. The Indiana Family and Social Services Administration requested federal approval for the move that would allow HIP members to use money in their health savings or power accounts for up to a year. The proposal is aligned with Indiana's Gateway to Work program, which launched this year and requires people on HIP 2.0 to meet work requirements. It is open for public comments for 30 days.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill and Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry are again clashing over a state abortion lawsuit. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the latest conflict between the two attorneys' offices.
Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry is often named in lawsuits challenging Indiana anti-abortion laws. That's because many of the abortions performed in the state are done in his jurisdiction. In the latest suit, challenging a new law that largely bans a second trimester abortion procedure, Curry wants a city lawyer to represent his office. His argument, he's named in the case and has the right to bring in outside counsel. But Attorney General Curtis Hill, a Republican, wants to block Curry's attorney from appearing in the case. He argues state laws are defended by his office, not local prosecutors, even when those prosecutors are technically the ones being sued. Last year, Curry, a Democrat, wanted to concede a lawsuit challenging a 2018 state anti-abortion law. Hill's office took up the law's defense there, too, losing its initial fight in federal court. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Environmental Protection Agency has added water contamination in Logansport to the Superfund program's National Priorities List. The list makes some of the most polluted sites in the country eligible for federal funding for cleanup. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, the agency is still not sure where the pollution is coming from.
Last year, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management found the cancer-causing chemical PCE in drinking water wells in the Logansport area. The EPA says it doesn't know where the pollution is coming from right now, but Logansport's mayor, Dave Kitchell, says there was an old dry cleaner and a landfill near the wells at one time. He says the water is an important economic development resource for the community.
And that water is used not only for water customers in the city limits, but for patients, residents, and employees at Logansport State Hospital.
IDEM says the city water is treated and safe to drink. But Kitchell says people who have private wells in Clinton Township may want to test their water for PCE just in case. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Estimates show most rural Indiana counties will lose a significant portion of their workforce by 2040, and state policymakers are taking notice. Blackfoot County in northern Indiana is said to be the hardest hit. The study estimates they could lose nearly 40% of their workforce population. Stakeholders discussed how to retain talent at Indiana University's Rural Conference in French Lick Tuesday. It's a big challenge in rural areas that often lack the amenities businesses and younger workers want. That's why the state is trying to help those communities improve what's called quality of place. The term is broad, but includes investments that help make a location more livable, like new trails, shopping, venues for the arts, and restaurants. Indiana's Office of Community and Rural Affairs plans to funnel $100,000 in grants to help communities enhance their culture. Colette Childress is a project manager at Okra. She says she's confident state resources will lead to results.
Okra really wants to focus on creating and retaining talent in Indiana. We want to grow that talent in Indiana, and especially in rural. And we also want to create places where people want to be.
According to the study, only 14 counties are expected to grow their workforce population over the next 25 years, many of which surround large metropolitan areas.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
More than 1,000 people, including some of the nation's most notable public figures, gathered in Indianapolis Wednesday to say their final goodbyes to Richard Lugar. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the Hoosier political titan's funeral.
Those who spoke at the service, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Vice President Mike Pence, all talked about Richard Lugar's legacy in the state, the country, and the world. Former Georgia Democratic Senator Sam Nunn famously partnered with Lugar to help dismantle thousands of nuclear warheads. Nunn hailed Lugar's commitment to cooperation and compromise, which he says are too often misunderstood today.
Some take it as meaning you give up your principles. Dick Lugar never, ever compromised his principles.
Former Governor Mitch Daniels, a longtime Lugar staffer, says he learned a lot of lessons from the Hoosier icon.
He made a much better person out of me. And I know I'm only one of many here who are thinking that right now.
Lugar was the longest-serving Indiana senator, 36 years in office. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana NAACP is asking the state to include an environmental justice advocate on the new energy policy task force. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, the group met with Governor Holcomb to discuss the issue and other things this week.
Holcomb will appoint about half the members in the 15-person task force charged with developing the state's energy policy. Democratic Representative Sue Arrington co-authored the bill. She says other representatives wanted to make sure there were no special interests on the task force, including environmentalists and environmental justice advocates. But she thinks it's important the state include them.
There's certainly a concern, and I share it, that there are aspects that are missing.
The Indiana NAACP says people of color and low-income communities are often hit hardest by the pollution and climate impacts that come from burning fossil fuels. According to the state health department, 3 times as many black children in Indiana have asthma as white children. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Hundreds of school administrators from Indiana and neighboring states gathered in Indianapolis Monday for the 20th annual School Safety Specialist Academy. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Carter Barrett reports.
Mental health is a central topic for the 2-day School Safety Academy, which comes after 2 school shootings in Indiana last year. State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick says adequately addressing students' mental health needs is an ongoing issue in Indiana, and progress is slowed by a limited pot of funding.
Schools are looking from those mental health providers. They're looking for more social workers. They're looking for contracts with mental health providers. So those dollars are going to be gone quickly as many of the needs are continuing to increase across the state.
State lawmakers in the recent legislative session created some new options to address mental health issues, but not the comprehensive system some advocates say the state needs. The training also includes sessions on social media, sex trafficking, and school bus safety. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Carter Barrett.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Many teachers are calling for lawmakers to change a new licensing law going into effect in July. Teachers need ongoing education credits to renew their license. The new law means 15 of the 90 renewal credits have to come from workforce-focused programs. Thousands of teachers have started the process of renewing their licenses with the Department of Education to avoid the new rules. Indiana State Teachers Association President Teresa Meredith says the new requirements were created with little input from teachers. She says the rules ignore work teachers already do and add to the tension between people working in schools and the State House.
At the end of the day, it's really about this just being one more thing piled on educators from people who are not educators, who didn't ask educators.
PJ McGrew directs the governor's workforce cabinet. He says the state is working to offer more guidance ahead of the July 1st deadline, but the goal is to improve awareness of partnerships and what's going on outside of schools.
Just for the betterment of students so they can connect what they're learning with things in the real world.
PJ McGrew directs the governor's workforce cabinet. He says the state is working to offer more guidance ahead of the July 1st deadline, but the goal is to improve awareness of partnerships and what's going on outside of schools.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The CDC says smoking is the leading cause of cancer and cancer deaths. But research shows most smokers don't quit even while battling cancer. Side Effects Public Media's Lauren Bavis explains how some treatment centers are now doing more to help.
Most people knew James Strain as Butch. Dr. Cynthia Meneghini called him Dad. She remembers him as a handyman who could fix anything. When she moved to a new house, he painted it top to bottom, despite feeling pain in his ribs.
And he thought it was because he always fixed cars. And he thought, you know, he was rolling under cars all the time. He probably hurt his rib that way. But it turned out it was lung cancer that had already metastasized to his bone.
Meneghini is a primary care physician with Community Health Network in Indianapolis.
The daughter in me knew that was bad, but the physician in me knew that was really, really bad. Stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer.
More than 150,000 Americans die from lung cancer each year. And smoking is responsible for up to 90% of those deaths. Despite the high stakes, many people, including Meneghini's father, keep smoking after getting a cancer diagnosis. He died at age 73, 2 years after finding out he had cancer.
Most smokers enter and leave their cancer care without getting help quitting.
Dr. Michael Fiore heads the University of Wisconsin Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. In a recent commentary for the New England Journal of Medicine, he wrote that about half of cancer patients are smokers when they're diagnosed.
Until recently, we didn't realize how beneficial it is to quit immediately upon getting a cancer diagnosis.
Research shows cancer patients who quit smoking respond better to treatment. They tolerate chemotherapy better and have fewer surgical complications. They're more likely to survive cancer and less likely to get cancer again. But research also shows many cancer treatment programs don't include support to help patients quit smoking.
A lot of times it used to be the old view is that you already have cancer and it doesn't matter, you just keep smoking, it doesn't matter anymore. And that's completely wrong.
Graham Warren is a researcher at the Medical University of South Carolina. His research found most oncologists ask patients if they smoke and tell them to stop, but fewer than half provide direct support to quit. Instead, doctors focus on treating cancer.
Patients can receive treatment from the oncologist, but in healthcare setting now, it's very difficult for oncologists to provide cessation support with everything else.
Lisa Carter-Harris of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York says many smokers don't even tell their doctor they smoke for fear of being blamed for their illness. During her research, she said smokers told her,
"Don't they know that I know that? I want to stop smoking. I need help and I need, you know, some empathy. I don't need someone giving me a lecture."
To bridge the communication gap, some cancer treatment centers are highlighting programs to help patients quit. Last year, the National Cancer Institute funded a program in Indianapolis. Dr. Mimi Seppa is a thoracic surgeon at the Indiana University Melvin and Bren Simon Cancer Center.
So we're being more active about it as opposed to passive about reaching out to all of the patients who are smokers.
New patients are asked for a detailed medical history. Smokers are flagged in the electronic records system. Then a doctor like Seppa can start a conversation about quitting and refer the patient to treatment. That includes everything from offering nicotine patches to prescribing medicine at a pharmacy that doesn't sell cigarettes.
The treatment plan for each patient gets personalized to what is best and what will most likely be successful for each patient.
Doctors hope this intervention means fewer patients return to the center. I'm Lauren Bavis, Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
About 100,000 Kentucky children are being raised by people other than their parents, a number that puts Kentucky above all other states. A great number of these cases are because of issues stemming from the opioid epidemic, incarceration, abuse, or neglect. And a great number of grandparents are raising these children. Side Effects Public Media's Lisa Gillespie reports that this can put a grandparent in a difficult situation in a state where many people live in poverty and have big health issues.
Getting to Ann Polston's house is a journey. First, you have to get to Liberty, a town about 2 hours southeast of Louisville. Then there's a winding 8-mile road that's largely one lane and sometimes just gravel. At the end is Polston's 3-bedroom home, crammed with toys and VHS tapes and beaten-up furniture. Polston is raising 4 children, ages 2, 4, 8, and 16. But she's 51 years old, and their grandmother.
The 2 older ones call us Grandma and Papa, and the 2 babies say Mom and Dad.
The kids were born to Polston's stepdaughter, but when drug problems hit the parents, Polston and her husband got custody rights.
You know, as the saying goes, grandparents can spoil them and send them home. Well, we don't have that option unless we want to put them in foster home, and that's not an option for us. We don't want it.
But watching over 4 kids is taking a toll.
We're not spring chickens anymore. We can't keep running after them all the time, so it wears.
There's mixed research on how raising kids affects a grandparent, says Bert Hayslip, a University of North Texas professor. On one hand, grandparents might work longer and make decisions on the fly, improving cognition. But there's also a big downside.
Many grandparents seem to put their own needs behind those of the grandchildren. This includes medical and, for that matter, emotional needs in many cases.
Dr. John Fulton sees the impact at an outpatient mental health center at a local hospital.
They usually come in with complaints of either depression or stress/anxiety. They come in, some of them feeling guilty because they're aggravated at having to do this.
There are other problems, too. Polston has 2 slipped discs in her back from working at the post office. Back at her house, Polston picks up 2-year-old Sissy to change her pull-up.
Ouch! Ouch! Killing my back, kid.
In 2017, 63,000 children were in the care of grandparents in Kentucky. That's 6% of all kids in the state. And it's clear the opioid epidemic plays an outsized role. In a nationwide survey, that was the reason cited by 70% of grandparents who were raising grandkids. To help out, Polston and her friend Clydene Campbell formed the Alternative Parents Action Council. It's a support group that also teaches caregivers about available state benefits.
When social services gives you these children, they don't explain to you how to get the benefits or what you have to do.
Campbell is 58 and raising 4 of her sister's grandchildren.
And I mean, I love the children, but it's really hard at my age. I tell everybody all the time, I don't remember being a mother being this hard.
The state offers limited resources, like some money and daycare assistance, unless grandparents go through a rigorous foster parent process. But the state hasn't always told grandparents about the help that is available. Now the state is starting to reach out more. But Terry Brooks from Kentucky Youth Advocates says that's not enough.
The state needs to make a much stronger and more consistent commitment to providing those supports like training and like respite care than currently is being done.
Like training and how trauma can influence a kid's behavior. And respite care, basically a babysitter, so people like Caldwell can take a break.
My big vacation for this year was spending a weekend in Harrodsburg, so... I got away from the kids for 2 days, but still, I got to rest for a couple days.
For now, Polston and Campbell hope members of their group can babysit for each other, so these grandparents can rest up before going back to nonstop parenting. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Lisa Gillespie in Louisville.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
There is now a new book out about Hall of Fame sports broadcaster Harry Carey that goes beyond his years with the Cubs. The legendary Harry Carey, baseball's greatest salesman, was written by Don Zmenda. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson recently spoke with Zmenda about things that were not widely known about the legendary broadcaster.
You wrote this book, The Legendary Harry Carey, Baseball's Greatest Salesman. Why did you write it?
Harry is a pretty famous person in the broadcasting field. He died in 1998. He's in no danger of being forgotten. There's a statue of him outside of Wrigley Field, the Cubs ballpark in Chicago. When the Cubs play the seventh inning stretch song, Take Me Out to the Ball Game, that Harry made famous by leading the crowd, they often just show a video of him leading the crowd. I felt that he is now remembered mostly for his Cub years when he was a kind of grandfatherly figure. And he also becomes something of a figure of fun. There were Will Ferrell imitations of him. He mangled names toward the end of his career. He forgot things. That really wasn't the whole Harry. That really wasn't the best Harry. He broadcast for over 50 years. He broadcast significantly for 3 major league teams, the Cardinals and the White Sox, as well as the Cubs. Those stories are equally fascinating as his Cub years are. And also his own personal story is almost Dickensian. It's a fascinating story. I really wanted to put the whole Harry into perspective and to tell his complete life story.
So if you could give me a Cliff Notes version of what people don't talk about, what they don't remember, and what you wanted them to know about those early years. Why is that? Why do you think they remember those later years and not those early years?
Toward the end of his years with the Cubs in particular, he became a national cable TV star. WGN, which is the Cubs' home station, was able to be broadcast throughout the country. So people everywhere in America could watch Cub games on a daily basis and watch and listen to Harry. He became so famous that he appeared on shows like David Letterman. He actually led the Democratic delegates at the 1996 convention in Chicago and singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. He sang that song with Robert Merrill of the New York Opera. He was just a legendary figure, but that fame was so great that I really think that the rest of the story is in danger of being forgotten a little bit.
So what do you think people should know?
First of all, his personal story. He was born in 1914, which is the year the World War I started. He never knew his father. His father went away to World War I, was an immigrant from Europe, actually probably born in Albania, although I think his heritage was Italian. Harry really never knew his father because his father never came back from World War One. Harry didn't know whether he died or lived. There's still a mystery about that because all record of him has disappeared. He was raised by his mother, who was also a European immigrant and very poor. His mother became seriously ill. She remarried when Harry was an adolescent, but then died 2 years later. He was raised by a paternal uncle and his aunt, and then the uncle left. So Harry really had a very difficult childhood, had a lot to overcome in his life. It really affected his private life a lot. Publicly, he was this outgoing, personable guy, friend of everyone, could connect with strangers easily. Privately, with his own family, he had much more difficulty. In the book, I talked at some length with both his widow, Dutchie, and with his grandson, Chip, who is also a broadcaster, now works for the Atlanta Braves. And Chip kind of put it in perspective when he said, Harry never had trouble being Harry. He had a lot of trouble being dad or grandfather. But toward the end of his life, he was really able to warm up to and connect with his own family to a significant degree. Almost became a different person by the time that he died in his 80s.
And that charisma, what do you think made him so fascinating to people?
Well, Harry always said that he felt like he was the voice of the fans and that he considered himself a fan behind the mic. And not so much in his Cub years, but especially during his White Sox and Cardinal years, he was completely unfiltered about expressing his opinions about what was happening on the field. If he felt the player wasn't hustling or playing well, Harry would openly criticize him. If he was feeling that the management of the team wasn't doing enough to make the team better, he would express his opinions on the air. And that really became something that made him beloved to fans because they felt that he was their voice. There's an incident in the book where the White Sox were finishing a very dismal year when Harry was broadcasting for him. The last game of the season, instead of broadcasting the game, he went down into the stands during the last three innings and just interviewed fans and said, what do you think about this team? How do you think they're going to improve? What do you feel about them now and about next year? And he really gave voice to their own opinions. That's something that Harry was absolutely brilliant at.
You wrote the book because you wanted these stories to be told.
I did. And also, I was a Chicago boy. And I have to tell you that I have been a White Sox lifelong fan, really, from the time that I started following baseball in the 1950s. And a big story in the book and a big part of Harry's own story in broadcasting was that after spending 11 years with the White Sox, he switched to the Cubs and became much more famous and popular with the Cubs than he ever was with the White Sox, in part because of the whole Wrigley Field persona and also especially because the Cubs were such a nationally known team by being broadcast coast to coast. I felt that his White Sox years, which were equally compelling, were being left a little bit in the background. Those years were simply fascinating. The White Sox often had a bad team. Harry was totally unafraid to criticize the players and even the management. He called his own owner an idiot because he felt that the owner wasn't doing enough to improve the team. And those years were so interesting and compelling that I really felt that that part of the story should be told equally as much as the Cubs story was.
So was he not open and opinionated and the voice of the fans when he was the Cubs broadcaster?
He was still, but not to the degree that he was with the White Sox. I think that there's documentation that I talk about in the book that when he moved to the Cubs management kind of quietly called him aside and said, Harry, we want you to be honest. We don't yet want you to be afraid to criticize players when they do something wrong. But you really have to get out of attacking people personally. And the management of the team was pretty much off limits as far as criticism was concerned. Not completely, but certainly not to the degree that was the case with the White Sox. And also, he was older. He was so popular. He was having fun broadcasting the games. And also in his personal life, as I mentioned before, he was a happier person. I think he didn't have the sort of edge that he had during his White Sox years and during his Cardinal years as well.
I read, anyway, that he was definitely afraid of cows, but he kind of coined the phrase, holy cow, made it famous. How did you come upon that little fact?
Well, as Harry became kind of a national celebrity with the Cubs, he started getting offers for commercial products. And there was a soft drink company in the Chicago area that wanted to market a soft drink called Holy Cow. And they were going to have Harry's picture on the containers. And as part of the opening launch of the product, they decided that it would be fun to show Harry with a cow and have him kind of walking a few steps and leading the cow by the rope. The Chicago media person that I talked to that was working on that promotion said Harry was so afraid of cows that he wouldn't come anywhere near it. And so that promotional project kind of fell flat, and the soft drink ultimately was not very successful.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Kira Amstutz from Indiana Humanities.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Americans seem to see each other differently, depending on whether they happen to live in urban communities or in suburban communities or out in the countryside, for that matter, too. That is drawn based from polling and from analysis by academicians and others, that we seem to be divided culturally by geography. Well, that's what the Indiana Humanities has decided to take on in a major project that's going to basically last the next 2 years. And with us to talk about this program, which is entitled Inseparable, that's IN for Indiana, the abbreviation, of course, we have with us today Kira Amstutz. She's the president and CEO of Indiana Humanities. And Kira, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, Chris, I'm delighted. You guys are such a terrific partner up in the northwest part of the state, and happy to be with you.
Well, maybe we talk about Indiana Humanities. Maybe you recognize the organization because we have been bringing in the past year or so the Quantum Leap Initiative comments, the programs that they've come out of Indianapolis to bring to northwest Indiana. And let's talk now about the importance, I guess, of the planning that you all did to come up with this rather interesting dynamic dealing with rural and urban life in Indiana that's kind of led into the creation of the Inseparable Initiative.
Absolutely. So Indiana Humanities is a statewide nonprofit, and we work in all 92 counties across the state. And so one of the great benefits of having that kind of a wide-ranging audience is that we get out and we get to hear what people care about. And I think that particularly during the state bicentennial year in 2016, and certainly since then, we've heard a lot of Hoosiers say, you know, you hear in the media all the time that there's such a gap between rural and urban, that the issues aren't the same, that people don't care about the same things. And I think our observation on the ground is I think these perceived divisions are overblown. And what we see is a real consistency in what Hoosiers care about, why they appreciate the state, what they hope for with their families. And so we've decided to spend the next couple of years, we have a whole dizzying array of programs we can talk about and ways people can participate, but thinking a little bit about this perceived divide and thinking about why does it matter that we as Hoosiers have a common identity, that we can come together around issues to solve problems. I know you just had Claire, Fitty, and Green on, and my goodness, the marvelous things they're doing to help fight smoking, you know, help bring down the smoking rate and work on the opioid crisis and certainly focusing on education. You know, again, I think there's so much more that we Hoosiers have in common than what divides us, and we're hoping that we can have some conversations about that.
I know that the overall aim or goal, I guess, is to be able to take advantage of the humanities. And when you talk about the humanities, of course, that encompasses a lot of things, literature, history, poetry, philosophy, other related disciplines together to help try and bring rural and urban families and organizations and communities together.
You betcha. I mean, we have some unique tools in the humanities. And one of the favorite tools that we have is certainly reading and discussion. So one of the programs that we're really excited to announce, and this was just unveiled yesterday at the State House. We were glad that the Lieutenant Governor was with us and helped us pull the curtain off the new book that we're encouraging Hoosiers to read over the course of the next year, and it's called The Year We Left Home, and mm-hmm. it's by Jean Thompson. And so for folks who like to have community reads, who have a book club, who are looking for a really good read, that it covers a Midwestern family and reasons they left home and reasons they came back and all kinds of things that happened in between. So I think it's going to be a great community read, and we hope that we can encourage lots of people to read and chat about it.
Now, with all the hundreds and thousands of books that are out there, what prompted you all to pick this particular book?
You know, it had just that sweet spot for us of covering, you know, this urban-rural question, and it's a Midwestern story. And one of the things that I think maybe not enough folks are talking about is there has been such a resurgence in terrific Midwestern literature. This is a golden era for Midwestern literature, and we were really excited to choose a book by a Midwestern author.
I know one of the nice things that Indiana Humanities tries to do is try to bring people together to talk and set up conversations of different kinds. And I know that this particular series of the Inseparable initiative, actually the two-year initiative that's underway, has a couple of these chances for people to get together in different communities to talk about. Tell us first about the In Conversation series.
Well, the In Conversation series is, it has kind of it sounds like a fancy name, but what it really is a moderated conversation series where we bring in interesting writers and thought leaders and, you know, folks that can help us think about the world in different ways. So our first one that will kick off next week, that's part of the series, is an In Conversation with Jim and Deb Fallows. They have written a book called Our Towns. And they are really cool writers. They fly their own small plane, and they flew 400,000 miles around the country, going to communities, mid-size and small, talking to people, interviewing folks, listening, and finding out what is the key to a vital community these days. What communities are responding well to change? What communities are really setting themselves apart? And what is that? You know, what could they observe that maybe other communities could learn from? And so they're coming to Indianapolis, Muncie, Fort Wayne, and Angola as part of this tour. So that's just the first one that we'll have over the course of the next 2 years. But look for other opportunities to participate in conversation.
Well, it's interesting that they should have these people with their talk entitled Our Town coming to Muncie in particular, which of course is famous for the Middletown Project, the Lens that came in and did the study back in the 20s and 30s into one particular community and how they chose Muncie to look into how the all-American community should be. It'd be interesting to see what they have to say in relationship of all these years later they see.
You are right on. I mean, that Middletown Studies program was fascinating. And if you look at a lot of national literature, Indiana has often been viewed as that, you know, kind of every town USA kind of model, that we really have been thought of as the middle of everywhere, which is actually, you know, maybe the center of everywhere.
Yeah.
So they were fascinated by Muncie. And actually, this Our Towns is a book. So if any of your readers out there would like to pick this up, it's available. It's now in paperback. But they do reference Muncie in the book, and the president of Ball State is going to be moderating that conversation, and we know all the Middletown Studies folks are going to be there. So I think it'll be a very rich discussion, and certainly something, something that'll be valuable to the Muncie community as they look at ways to continue to grow and prosper.
We're talking with Kira Amstutz, who's the president and CEO of Indiana Humanities, about Inseparable, which is the next two-year initiative that the organization based in Indianapolis is reaching out across the Hoosier State to deal with. And we talked about this In Conversation series that's underway first. And coming up in April, we know that there's going to be another opportunity for people to sit down over meals and talk about things. What turns into like now the annual Chew on This project. This is coming up. And one of those stops, by the way, is going to be in Rensselaer. Tell us about the program.
Oh, it is one of my favorite programs. So it's called Chew on This, and the theme of this one, not surprisingly, based on our conversation, is what divides us. So on April 23rd, you can sign up to be part of this dinner discussion series. As you mentioned, you'll have one up in Northwest Indiana in Rensselaer, but we'll have 8 other locations around the state all meeting at the same time, all having the same kind of conversation. And the way this works is you pay a small fee for the dinner, and we have a wonderful facilitator at each location who can lead the group in conversation. It's kind of like dining with strangers, but it's so much fun. And you often walk away with a new friend, a new perspective, a new appreciation for perhaps a great restaurant in your community. And I encourage everyone to check it out and sign up.
Now, kind of going along with the idea of urban and rural, we know small Indiana towns get a chance to participate in all of this over the next couple of years with a traveling Smithsonian curated exhibit. Tell us about Crossroads Change in Rural America.
See, I told you there are a million components of this program. So again, we're finding lots of ways for everybody to plug in. So we are incredibly proud that we were able to work with the Smithsonian to bring this exhibit to Indiana. And it's called Crossroads Change in Rural America. It is going to help the communities that host it think a little bit about how rural America has changed over time. And then each community that's hosting will be able to create a component of the exhibit that's very personal to their community and their place. And right now we have, there are six hosts, and the way this program works is the communities that host it need to be smaller than 15,000. So this is a tremendous opportunity for our smaller rural areas to get to host a museum-quality, amazing exhibit with the support of the Smithsonian behind it. So the six sites are Dillsboro, Indiana, or the Aurora Public Library in Dillsboro, Washington County Historical Society in Salem. We have Jennings County Historical Society in Vernon. Up north, we've got Elkhart County Historical Museum in Bristol, North Manchester Center for History in North Manchester, and then finally one other Southern Indiana site, the historic New Harmony, folks will be hosting it. So this will happen between September of this year and June of next year. It's a beautiful exhibit. Each of the hosts will do tons of programming around it, have speakers, have tours, have lots of opportunities to engage. But again, we're really jazzed that we were able to talk the Smithsonian in to bring in the exhibit here.
And I know the information here that the Indiana Humanities has put out talks about not only having an opportunity for people to see exhibits and talk about the issues, but filmmakers can get involved in putting together some work as well, too, to get, bring these stories of rural and urban and suburban Hoosiers together. Tell us about the film project.
Well, the film project is very exciting, and this is where we are looking for creativity. So if you know a filmmaker out there, will you please have them contact us? All of your listeners, please, filmmaker in your life, have them connect with us. We are looking for filmmakers who can help us understand the rural, urban, suburban dynamic in Indiana, and this is why we need excellent storytellers. These are going to be short films. But again, we will. We have a call right now for filmmakers. So if you fill out the call and we select you, we have resources that can help you put your film together. And then we did a similar project recently with the focal point being the White River. And not only do we help support the filmmakers in making the films, but when they're done, we have film release parties. We share them widely. It's a really great way to tell stories, which is a big part of what the humanities do, and we're incredibly excited to be able to involve filmmakers in this journey.
And we know there are a couple other points, too, I'd like to bring up that will get the public involved in the questions that will be brought up during this inseparable two-year initiative. One of them is a poster, and the other are getting speakers lined up. Tell us first about the poster program that's going to be underway, and then about the Speakers Bureau.
Okay, so if you are working in a school or a library, no worries, it's going to be automatically sent to you. And so one of the things that we like to do with our themed programs is create some kind of cool visual poster that helps illustrate some of the information and the facts that we're, you know, kind of basing the conversation on. So this particular poster is really cool. It helps us understand the changing demographics of our state over the past 100 years. And it's beautifully done. We worked with Muncie Map Company to create it, some very talented folks there. And it is free. So if you're interested in getting one of these gorgeous posters, you can contact us at IndianaHumanities.org, our website, and request one, and we'll send it to you. But if you are with a library or a school, we will send them to every school and library in the state for free.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the Speakers Bureau is something interesting. That's something brand new, I understand.
It is brand new, and I spent a lot of time yesterday going through all, it's essentially a catalog online where if you would like to bring in a speaker to think about any of the issues that you and I have talked about today and more, we have what's called the Speakers Bureau. So we have a catalog of speakers. You look through that. You say, oh, my gosh, that speaker idea sounds amazing. This person sounds amazing. I'd like to host them at my school, at my community center, at my neighborhood meeting. You apply to us to host. You send it's a very short application. You say what speaker you'd like to hear and basically when. And then if we select your community to be a host, we'll pay for that speaker to come and present. And your job is to get folks there and to make the most of it. So it's a really wonderful opportunity. We're delighted to have enough funding to do that. And there are dozens of speakers in this catalog with some just incredible talks. So please check it out and let us know if you would like to apply.
Once again, Inseparable is a two-year Indiana Humanities Initiative. It invites Hoosiers to look into how we relate to each other across boundaries, whether they're real, whether they're in someone's imagination or whatever, and to be able to look into how what it would take to become inseparable in all of the ways that seem to matter. And this initiative is like many of the others that the Indiana Humanities has had. The last one that we've talked about, and we've actually had programs on the air about, was the Quantum Leap program, which kind of dealt into STEM, the science, technology, engineering, math, science, medicine fields. What kind of response can you tell us that you have received from this past initiative that just ended?
I'm so grateful that you ask. And again, thank you so much. It was wonderful being able to partner with your station to air. If you heard the Quantum Leap sound bites, I know we had some of our audio storytelling that appeared on the station, and I think that was a fun element of the program. But just as a quick snapshot, we did a statewide read of Frankenstein. So our book last year was Frankenstein. It was the 200th anniversary. We had over 600 programs statewide that
That's
reached
right.
thousands and thousands of people. You know, we had, I can't even begin to tell you how much excitement there was out there for thinking about that book, thinking about the impact today, how we think about the limits of science, you know, how we understand our world and otherness through that book. And it was really magical to celebrate Mary Shelley's book 200 years later with such a big party.
Well, now, Kira, you have time left just to tell us what the website address is and where people can find out more in particular about all of these elements of the Inseparable initiative that will be taking place now.
Well, the best place to go is to our website. That's indianahumanities.org. And you can find links to all of the programs that I've mentioned. And if you have any questions at all, there's a staff list. Reach out to us. We'll be happy to help.
That's Indiana Humanities CEO Kira Amstutz. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.